I'll say just a little bit about my experience of coming back from the Amazon, and you know, 2 years is a long time, and anthropology is a bit of an extreme sport, and the whole idea is that you tear yourself out of your culture, you plunge into this radically different one, and then you go the full 10 yards, and then you kind of come back. And my experience was the hardest part was coming back to. I had a hard time recognizing my world. I mean, you know, when you've lived with people who grow their own food and live in the rainforest, and they gather and fish and hunt, and they make their own homes and clothes, and they make more or less everything except machetes, which they purchase. And then you come back to your world, and people are lining up at the supermarket and buying stuff wrapped in plastic and paying with bits of paper. And you think, oh, wait, this is reality. This is normal. This is where I come from. It took me a long time to reconcile myself with my own culture, and yeah, it took years, in fact. And I'm sure everybody will be different on this count. One of the things that I found hard was that even my friends didn't really want to listen to me talk about the Amazon and how the Indians do it and so on, because I guess they got tired of it after a couple of times. Well, I turned to public speaking and to writing books, and actually to be able to make sense of it and download it into my culture, and find the words for it, and how to share what I'd learned in the Amazon, how to even put it into English or French, how to make rational sense of what these shamanic rainforest Indians said. It took years, and then finally, you know, it was mo I, it took reading molecular biology to understand it from my point of view. It's like, okay, this kind of invisible world with animate essences that's full of information, that's somehow all around us and available to us. Oh yeah, well, isn't that also what molecular biology is about? Ah, yeah, well, so here's some Western scientific concepts that I can actually use as a kind of by analogy for what shamans are saying. Ah, well, then I could suddenly wrap my mind around it. Bringing it back and coming back into this culture, and then finding a place for oneself, and finding how to get a dialogue going inside one's own mind about these two different ways of understanding the world, and seeing how they might work together, was long and difficult. I kind of compare it to learning two languages, like becoming bilingual. Language, sometimes you get rusty in your own language, and it takes going back and forth a lot between different languages to be able to get perfectly bilingual. And I think it's the same with bicognitivism. I mean, you can be a kind of a rationalist and then open your mind to a shamanic way of seeing things. I'm having some doubts about whether the microphone is actually working. Anyway, I'll just keep talking in the hope that it is. Okay, good. Well, then, what I'll say to put stuff on the table, thinking through how to think about, let's just say, what shamans say and what Amazonian cultures say. Here we are speaking in English, but it would actually be the same in any European language, Italian or French or any one of them. Our culture has a lot of dichotomies in it, and we tend to come up with like these concepts or words like nature, for example. Actually, nature is defined in opposition to culture, and this is the tendency to dichotomize. I mean, we split things up like body and mind, or matter and mind, or nature and culture. So nature is everything that isn't human, and culture is everything that is human. Those are basically the dictionary definitions. But defining this entity as everything that is not human, in other words, plants, animals, and all the rest except humans, this is a very Western concept. This is a concept by people who've already separated themselves from the other species. When you go to the Amazon and you ask people, how do you say nature? They say, well, they don't have a word for nature. Actually, they consider that the other species are humans like us, and there's no fundamental difference between humans and non-humans. It's a lot more ambiguous. The categories are a lot less clear cut. And so, here we are thinking in terms of nature, and we think, oh yes, Amazonian Indians are closer to nature than we are, but in fact, they don't even have that concept. And so we're projecting that concept onto them, but it's actually our concept and not theirs. And once again, trying to make sense of a radically different culture sends us straight into the mirror, looking at our own presuppositions, which is interesting. But I think that it's important to pay attention to the words that one uses and the concepts that one vehicles. And it's important to kind of deconstruct a lot of the Western dichotomies in our vocabularies before we even the dark side of shamanism is something that tends to disappear when one talks about ayahuasca shamanism in the West. But when you're in the indigenous context, it's in the Amazon, it's just clear to everybody that at least 50% of what shamanism is actually what they call sorcery. There's a book. Here's a book. It's in let me see, how's it go? Yeah, can I get it here? In Darkness and Secrecy, The Anthropology of Assault, Sorcery, and Witchcraft in Amazonia. Just to be clear, ayahuasca shamans say that they have magic darts or virote that they carry around in their stomach, and actually, the power to harm is the same as the power to heal, and extracting darts requires darts. And in fact, in some indigenous languages, the word for dart is the same as the word for knowledge. So there's no clear-cut category, no clear-cut difference between a shaman and a sorcerer, and between a dart that can be used to heal or to harm. And no real difference between dart and knowledge and power in their cultures. Everything is more ambiguous, and when we come at it with our clear-cut Western categories, where good is opposed to evil and so on, we have a hard time making sense of it. And actually, this is one thing. If you look at it in bad, that's something that I think deserves some consideration. And so then there is this question of sorcery. It's a delicate subject. A lot of people in the Western world actually consider that it doesn't really exist, or it only works if you believe in it, or but actually, if somebody asked for my advice, let's just say somebody who'd never really heard of this stuff, and they're about to go to a place in the Peruvian Amazon, which is a sorcery zone, I don't think it's good for your health, even if you don't believe in it. I think this is something that requires more research, but it's not very easy research. Just how affected by sorcery can Westerners who don't believe in it be? I don't think anybody's actually really looked into it, but and it's not something that I recommend you do it. There really is a dark side to this phenomenon, and then all you have to do is do a bit of reading on the theory of power. I mean, guys like Michel Foucault and stuff have written about this, that knowledge is power, and power is ambiguous, and it can be yielded for good, and it can be wielded for less good. And I think also that this is, in indigenous terms, a shaman is never entirely white. And the more a shaman actually manages to heal people, the more power that shaman has, and the more the temptation to abuse the power grows. And so I think that that's where the community comes in. The community is supposed to keep an eye on the shaman, and that's one of the questions that one can ask oneself in this world, where there are neo shamans and neo ayahuasqueros who are operating on an individual level outside of a community. Who's keeping an eye on them? So that's something that we can talk about. I'd like to mention Datura. Datura gets put into ayahuasca mixes. Datura is a bit of a sorcery plant. I personally don't think it is preferable to not have Datura in the ayahuasca one consumes. I think Datura has been used to turn people into consenting victims. It actually, I think that the whole idea that if one inspires oneself from Amazonian people, and one considers plants as beings, plants as intelligent beings, so we get away from a kind of the Western view is that vegetables are mindless, and we call people who are in a coma, we say they're vegetables, but actually if one looks at plants in another way, well, one can see that plants are actually sentient beings, and they perceive the world around them, and they make decisions, and they actually are sentient beings, and they're made of cells just like you and me, and their cells send one another signals just like our own neurons send one another signals, and actually science has started studying it. So the Amazonian point of view is confirmed, and it presents us with another view of nature. It's about this being inspired by Amazonian cultures and Amazonian points of view. Plants as beings, the whole world is alive, and this leads us to reconsider the nature of nature. I could go on. I think that ayahuasca is first and foremost about seeing. I'm not the first guy to say this. Many other people have made the point that it starts with seeing. As the anthropologist Jean-Pierre Chaumet put it, it's first there's vision, then there's knowledge, and finally there's power. And that is the those are the three stages along which one progresses. I'll make a few comments on what is called ayahuasca tourism. I think it's something that's interesting. It's a kind of an intercultural. This is also a long tradition, and I think that what is called ayahuasca tourism fits right into that. A lot of the people that I've met in Peru who go and are interested in ayahuasca experiences are serious people. Many of them are professionals, and they're interested in sort of moving away from the consumer world and getting back to something a bit more meaningful. And they're not afraid of going through with the ordeal. It's not at all a kind of a quick fix scene. It's a little bit hybrid and it's a little bit experimental, but it's interesting. I think there's a few problems. It's not without problems, obviously, but nothing is without problems. One of them is the desire that quite a few Westerners bring for authenticity, and the authentic shaman, and this actually involves quite a bit of projection of the ideas that people carry around with what is a real Amazonian Indian. And then you actually, because it's an intercultural space and always has been, shamans and ayahuasqueros are attentive to the expectations that their clients have, and then they play to it and dress like indigenous shamans. And so there's a kind of a theatrical game going on. I think the more one can be aware of one's projections, the better. And I think authenticity is a troubling concept. If the shaman wears an indigenous dress or not, what really counts is the quality of the brew and the quality of the singing. Meanwhile, there's the question of payment. Well, it's just completely normal to pay a shaman. The idea that there should be no payment is wrong. What can one do? What can one do for people? Well, just being clients is pretty good. Be clients. I think that where there is a problem, problems emerge in some Amazonian context because people pay too much, and then these shamans get huge amounts of money, and then there's jealousy that comes, and then there's a sorcery among ayahuasca shamans that grows out of this jealousy. And so the too many gringos paying too much money can lead to problems. But so not paying is a problem, and paying too much to look into that yourself. And then there's the diet that needs to be followed, and I'm sure there are lots of folks out there with experience with diet, so we can talk about that. There's a problem of falling on unscrupulous shamans who really don't know their stuff and don't look after people, and people can be harmed by a bad ayahuasca session with a bad shaman. Then there's also the problem of sex assaults. A lot of these shamans are pretty good at enchanting people of the opposite sex, and there's all kinds of unsavory stories, so it's good to know about that. I think that ayahuasca experiences can challenge your worldview, and I think that's why people are kind of interested in them too. But people should know that it is like it's like going sailing on the high seas or something. It's not at all it's not easy. It's kind of deep water. It can really change the way that you look at the world, and it can be more than what some people bargained for. And I think it's good to know that before launching into it. Obviously, not all the ideas you get or visions that you see in the sphere of visions are valid and to be treated as such. It takes learning to have these experiences and then working on the information one gets. The sphere of visions needs to be embraced with prudence. So anyhow, those are some of the points that I've wanted to get on the table, and I'm looking forward to opening this up to the dialogue. Let me just run through some of the questions that got sent to the forum this week. I liked more or less every question, and so I'll read the questions and then give real quick answers, and then we can move on to the Q&A. So what are the modern applications of the entheogenic downloads or knowledge that can be gained from the ayahuasca experience? Well, in principle, there are really no limit to what can be learned with ayahuasca. People can learn about music, people can learn about biology, they can learn about themselves, they can learn about the cosmos. If you look at Benny Shannon's book, The Antipodes of the Mind, he says so himself. There is basically no limit. And then, so in other words, you can ask any question you want, as modern or as pre-modern as you want, and see what the sphere of visions has to say. Somebody asks how many ayahuasca experiences. Actually, the more time goes by, the more it seems that it's not a bad thing at all, and there's quite a good something quite good coming from it. The people interested in ayahuasca tend to be serious people who are interested in healing, health, alternative approaches to health, and rethinking things, and so on. I think that if one is into promoting the plants and promoting this form of knowledge, the point is to try to show with one's life just how pertinent this stuff can be. Obviously, the more that there are Westerners taking this stuff and actually doing something constructive with it, the better, and the proof will be in the pudding. So there it is. And could this be a form of planetary biospheric defense system? In other words, the biosphere is sending ayahuasca into the world of industrial people to make them a little less stupid. Is this a kind of a deliberate decision at the level of the biosphere? It kind of looks that way, doesn't it? But how do I feel about reducing entheogenic plants to their chemical constituents? Well, not too bad. It's kind of like saying, how do I feel about X-rays? If you look at a human being in an X-ray, or any being really, and you see the skeleton, it's real. It's part of who they are. It's not exactly. I'm not just a skeleton, but I am also a skeleton, and there's nothing wrong with being reminded occasionally that you have a skeleton. Likewise, there's nothing wrong about knowing what molecules are in the brew. But from there to say that that's the only perspective that's valid, and that I don't know, dimethyltryptamine explains everything, I think that would be a mistake. But still, yeah, know the molecules you imbibe for sure. Is ayahuasca truly the most complex entheogenic plant brew known to man? Well, it's a pretty sophisticated one. There are other sophisticated ones, including the dimethyltryptamine snuffs that the people on the other side of the Amazonian basin concoct. But yeah, in brief, the ayahuasca is a kind of an advanced designer drug combining a monoamine oxidase inhibitor with an orally inactive hallucinogen. It's a pretty smart combination. Is it true that tobacco led the ancient Amazonians to the discovery of the ayahuasca brew? Well, nobody can prove that one, and it could have been other plants. What the indigenous people that I've spoken with say, it's that people were taking other plants, and that's how they came up with the ayahuasca recipe. And whether it was datura or tobacco is, I think, finally anybody's guess. Given that so many of us are interested in going to the Amazon and participating in ayahuasca ceremonies, do you have any personal advice about traveling to the Amazon and participating in ceremonies? In other words, What would be your words of advice for those of us who have never been to the Amazon but plan on going in the near future? Well, that's a good question. A full answer would be kind of long, but yeah, I think my advice would be really to prepare for it like an expedition, onto the deep sea or into some kind of difficult terrain. When you go into the high mountains, you don't just go with a t-shirt and running shoes, and you got to take your sunscreen and your backpack and enough water, and if you've never done backpacking before, well then speak with people who have and get ready for it, and so likewise, if you've never been to a tropical country and you're about to go into the Amazonian environment in Peru, well, you got to think of which season you. I mean, you'd probably want to avoid rainy season just for starters. That's December to March, and but you'd want to get a guidebook like one of the Lonely Planet ones. And anyway, and it turns out that the shots they give you up north don't really do the trick down south. And obviously, you'd want to try to avoid malaria areas, and it's worth well speaking with the people who you're going to go and visit, and getting advice from them. Meanwhile, about getting ready for ayahuasca, if you've never had the experience, once again, I think that reading up on it, this is really the kind of subject where people gain from doing reading. And so I've put a couple of books on a recommended reading list, including anybody who's going to be working with ayahuasca. I think that the book to read would be Benny Shannon's book, The Antipodes of the Mind, Charting the Phenomenology of the Ayahuasca Experience. It really does lay out what people experience, how they experience it, and this kind of thing, and what to get ready for, and how to approach it. Robert Tyndall also has a good book on The Jaguar That Roams the Mind, which is all about an ayahuasca initiation of his. And so people have actually been there before, and yeah, it's kind of an expedition into uncharted. It's, well, uncharted, relatively uncharted for yourself. And so read up before you hit the road. Can LSD be as useful as organic entheogens? Well, depends what you mean by useful. I think low dose LSD is actually something that's pretty interesting in this world, but to everybody has their own thing. Do synthesized chemicals actually serve to detract from the potential of the spiritual experience and guidance that can occur during ego death? Well, maybe, chemicals besides LSD, I'm not really interested in, and I shouldn't really speak about them. I mean, maybe some people learn all kinds of things from ecstasy and ketamine or whatever, but it's never really been my cup of tea. Somebody says, I feel as though plant medicines allow us to communicate with our guides more easily than the chemicals do. Yeah, well, I have the same experience, and that's why I'm not that interested in chemicals. However, chemicals seem to force one to explore within oneself. It is a more introspective journey as opposed to a guided journey. Yeah, maybe. It's true. I think Terence McKenna said that he found that LSD was psychoanalytically grating. And I find that too. Strong doses of LSD can be like that. And it's true that the mushrooms and the ayahuasca, I find a lot more organic and a lot more a real dialogue with some kind of vegetal intelligence, really. And that's what makes it interesting. So, yeah, I'm all for the plants and not that hot on the chemicals. But, I think everybody is different, and presumably the people who are participating in this course are people who are mainly interested in plants. And I'm certainly looking forward to speaking with Kat Harrison about plants. So, do I consider that ayahuasca potion prepared in the traditional way is more valuable or safer or a better source for personal evolution than synthetic DMT? Well, I have a brief experience, a couple of experiences with smoking synthetic DMT, and I kind of found it like getting catapulted out of my body onto a kind of a strange science fiction planet for 3 minutes. And kind of found it, well, I mean, discombobulating for sure. I didn't really see the interest of being catapulted so quickly and so thoroughly out of my body into the complete other world, and then the next thing I knew, coming right back and not really getting much learning or anything. It was all so fast and kind of science fictiony and like just a completely different world. Whereas ayahuasca, it takes me into the organic world of the biosphere of this planet, it seems to me, and then it's a long, slow, and there's images and all kinds of stuff going on, and you have the leisure to observe it and think about it, and it feels well, organic, natural, and well, a lot more interesting. So. Yeah, I mean, if I would choose ayahuasca every time over synthetic DMT, but anyhow, that's just my taste. What are the best ways, in your opinion, to change a vast percentage of humanity at once? I just don't think it's possible to do that. I mean, I would subscribe more to the idea that one would want to try to be the change one wants to see in the world, as Gandhi put it, and one discovers that already that is a tall order. Just trying to have a be coherent with oneself and one's own ideas is already quite a thing. As in terms of trying to change a vast majority of humanity. I mean, guys like Hitler and Mao tried that, but failed kind of miserably. I'm not sure that that's the right goal, really. Do I believe that everything has been perfectly unfolding according to nature's plan? Well, I have a problem with the word believe, just for starters. Nature's plan, I mean, is it exactly a plan or what is the biosphere up to? I think is kind of anybody's guess still. And I think that it also uses mistakes and so on. And whether it's all been written in advance and planned out or whether it's sort of being made up and improvised as we go along, I think all that is kind of open to discussion. Yeah, DNA as a Saussurean code. Yeah, that's an important point. Just a quick word here. Ferdinand de Saussure was a Swiss linguist at the beginning of the 20th century, and he was the one who pointed out that the languages we use they use coding systems where the individual signs have no meaning. So, in other words, like in English, there are 26 letters, A, B, C, all the way up to Z. And each one of those individual signs has no meaning. The letter B by itself means nothing. It's only when these signs are associated according to a coding system that meaning emerges. And so, for example, the word CAT, cat, refers to a feline. But the word CAR, car, refers to an automobile. And why cat means feline and car means automobile is because these meanings have been arbitrarily attributed to those bunch of letters. But actually, the individual signs, C, A, T, have nothing to do whatsoever with the Saussure. So we talk about Saussurean codes. And for through the 20th century, it was thought that only human beings use this kind of coding system where the individual signs have arbitrary meaning. Until the genetic code itself was discovered. And yikes. Well, so I'll just continue with the list of questions. We'll pretend that those extraterrestrial sounds we heard were not anything to worry about. Okay, so about shamanic plants, why is it our perception of the magical reality they show us fades? I take it the question means how come after one has had a session, one goes back to normal consciousness? Yeah, well, somehow that's one of the remarkable things I think about the human brain and the human mind, is that it seems for most people anyway to have a program, for sort of consensual reality, and that's what it's kind of auto-dialed to. And then we take these substances or plants that switch the channel on us, and we watch the forest television for a bunch of hours, and then somehow the next day one goes back to normal consciousness, and one goes back to the normal program. And I think it's a rather beautiful thing, really, and to be able to go back and forth. And that was one of the things I was going to say about every time I have an ayahuasca experience is that I take the months that follow as the opportunity to actually download what I've seen in the visions into the reality of my life. And it takes a certain amount of discipline, but if you're having sessions all the time and visions all the time, you don't really have the opportunity to honor those visions properly by trying to download them into your life. And it just takes a lot of it takes a lot of living in normal consciousness, really. And that's what's interesting is that so one goes out of normal consciousness and one gets all kinds of ideas and insights and visions, and then one comes back into normal consciousness, and the whole point is to try to make it real and download it. That's where the real sport is. And that's what's good for you. It takes a certain amount of discipline, and it makes you lead your life more appropriately. At least that's how I take it. Then there's a question about how much Datura is in the brew, and yeah, I guess it is really a good thing to be able to. I mean, ideally, you see the preparation of the ayahuasca you drink. You know the person who's preparing it, and you trust that person. And yeah, ideally, that's how it's done. It's not always possible, of course, but and. Yeah, I think that the less datura that's in the brew, the better. But anyway, we can also talk about that. Now, there's one last question here that I'm going to go over, and before getting into Q&A, it's a question by Jonathan Davis in Melbourne, Australia. And he says, very recently, the Attorney General in Australia has put forward plans to make thousands of plant species illegal. There are currently only four plants listed as illegal here. Could you talk about any ideas the growing international community of vegetalistas have for helping policymakers understand the benefits of these plants? I'm already aware of the way the Santo Daime Church has had success in almost every territory they've been challenged. However, shamanism in general isn't as structured and has no links to the Catholic faith. As a filmmaker about to make a deeply meaningful project after 10 years of training, I'm concerned that a documentary, for example, could do more harm than good. Well, thanks for that question, Jonathan. About how one can help policymakers understand the benefits of these plants better. I mean, first of all, the whole thing that plants should be illegal is, I think, just clearly absurd. That any plant should be illegal is absurd, and kind of obnoxious, really. But then, there are people who just don't see things that way, and so, in fact, in most countries in the world, most psychoactive plants are illegal, and. It's nothing new, really. There's been inquisitions and this kind of thing for centuries, and intolerance of this kind of stuff. And I think that if one rushes towards policymakers and one tries to get them to see our point of view, it comes across as some kind of proselytism, and it's counterproductive. And I mean, obviously. I think that the only thing one can do, once again, is to try to be the change one wants to see in the world, and to show that these plants can actually be used well and intelligently for good purposes. I think there's a lot of work that's going on now with showing that psychedelics, for example, can be medicines, and they can help people, approach death more easily and deal with cluster headaches and so forth. That they actually are part of the human arsenal for dealing with difficulties. That they're tools, they're power tools. Yeah, they can be dangerous, but if used wisely, they can also be useful. And but convincing policymakers and the entire world that this is so, I think it's gonna take a while longer. There's a lot of intolerance and ignorance to get over, and I think it's good to be patient about it. And to a certain extent, we're condemned to being a bit underground, and like, hey, you want to work with plants? Well, you gotta hide it, because otherwise you can have trouble. I'm prepared. It's easy for me. I live in Switzerland, and they're beyond being fined, and nobody's going to come in here and start questioning me because I'm working with plants. I'm so more or less free to do what I want with plants inside my own home. And that's all I ask. I'm not asking for anybody to do what I do, or to asking for anybody's approval. I just want to be free enough to do what I want with the plants that I want to when I want to. And then I think that's one of the things is then try to, if you're going to work with plants, then show the world that you're a coherent person and that you live a healthy life, and be a good publicity for the plants. Obviously, if you have an inside track and you're friends with all kinds of policymakers and important people, then yeah, you can try to influence them if you want. But I think kind of the work at hand is away from the limelight mainly, and kind of in the margins. And that's also what's exciting about this conversation, is that we're all kinds of people in different kind of peripheral places, but here we can all be connected together and have a conversation.